No, we're not breaking into homes. We are taking over abandoned homes by the city.
This is Max Rameau, strategist, theorist, author, and organizer with Pan-African Community Action, and you are listening to The Next World, a podcast about building movements. Once a month on this show, we will explore and celebrate the work of poor people's movements, particularly in the U.S. We will highlight innovative and powerful organizing campaigns and community building led by women, LGBTQ folks, Black communities, and other people of color that are pushing the boundaries and have the potential to transform this society. Today on the show, we are focusing on radical responses to the housing crisis. Our guest today is Cole Williams with the New Orleans Citizens Relief Team. Her organization is seizing empty homes owned by the City of New Orleans and helping houseless people move in. Cole Williams is a singer, songwriter, musician, producer, recording artist, radio host, and organizer. Cole, thank you so much for joining me today. So I want to spend a little time talking with you about your amazing work down there. What is the Greater New Orleans Citizen Relief Team?
The Greater New Orleans Citizens Relief Team is just a group of citizens, volunteers, people that are like-minded, that all believe that there should be no homeless, no unhoused, no displaced people living on the street. We believe in humanity first. And so at the beginning of the COVID-19 global pandemic in March 2020, we started demonstrating outside of City Hall for the unhoused to have a place to shelter in place. So we advocated for them to get into the hotel rooms. And then after that started to happen, really our focus had always been long-term housing for the unhoused. And so from the hotel rooms, we started to really work with the unhoused, getting to know them, building relationships with them. They were demonstrating with us. So we got to know like what they want, you know, what kind of long-term housing do they want? And what kind of housing and long-term housing are they being offered by the systems that are already in existence? And so we discovered that the systems are supportive when you have an income, like a social security income or a disability, or even making money from a part-time job. But when you have like no resources, you know, like you just got out of prison and like your family's gone, or, you know, they're just people that don't have large families and don't have that support system. So we're thinking, what happens to these people, like the least of ours? So what we have been doing is using citizens' rights, taxpayer rights to renovate, reclaim and renovate blighted, abandoned homes that are owned by the city, which really means that they're owned by the taxpayers. And working on fixing up these homes with the unhoused persons that are going to live with them while teaching a marketable skill. But the really interesting thing that's been happening and that's really been exciting for me is that it's not just about the house. So it's not just about renovating a house with someone that lives on the street and saying, here, this is where you're going to stay now. It's about how can they make this a long-term practice? So what's happening with their health care? What's happening with their transportation? What's happening with their literacy? There's so many different aspects of life that need to be made whole in order for somebody to be self-sufficient. So being houseless to me is like a symptom of some sort of lack that happened somewhere in the developmental stages of somebody's life and throughout. So for example, two people that we're working with right now, two of our unhoused partners, Joe and Latrell, they both are enrolled in literacy classes, both at different stages of literacy. But, you know, I think about, okay, so we have one person that's 50 years old that has an education of a fourth grader. It's not just about reading and writing, but it's about comprehension. Mm-hmm. So how well can this 50-year-old man with a fourth grade education really move through our society? What is he really understanding? So we're not just renovating this home and teaching a marketable skill, but we want to teach them like what's happening, like why this process is important. So we're also training them to be leaders of this program. Myself and my other co-leader, Mr. Curtis Muhammad, we think it's really important that we share everything that we're doing with the unhoused, but also with our volunteers to create super transparency so that we're not giving fish. We're not just saying, this is what you need here, take it. But we're saying, this is what you need in order to never go hungry again. We want to teach you how to fish. And yeah.
It seems like you're doing both. You're both giving a fish and
you're teaching how to fish, because it also the of course the limitation of just teaching someone how to fish is that means until they know, until they learn it, then they're going to be hungry, you know. And if it takes them 2 days to learn it, then they're going to starve to death before they can use that skill. But I think the interesting thing to me, anyway, you know, a lot of organizers listen to this podcast. So the thing that's interesting to me, and I think would be interesting to organizers, and it seems like, and correct me if I'm mischaracterizing it, but it seems like that you and other organizers, for lack of a better term here, went into this thing with a certain set of ideas. You started protesting and you wanted certain things. But then once you started working with the group closely with it directly impacted people, and you started to have real back and forth communication, not just saying we're doing this for you, then even your ideas about what you wanted or what you thought were demands seem to have evolved, if not changed. Is that right?
Kinda. You know, we never went into it thinking that we wanted to just do something for a population. So I'll speak for myself personally. This actually started off as me wanting to have weekly concerts under the Claiborne Bridge for the unhoused. So before I set up, I actually went out there and I spoke to people living under the bridge to ask if they were interested in us having a concert. And if we did, like, what other things would they like? Would they like some toiletry kits? Do they want some food? You know, so we started building relationships then. And then a week later, the pandemic broke. And so I thought, well, this population that, like, I wanted to just, like, add some culture to their life, they actually have real needs that I wasn't focused on before, but I'm really focused on these needs now. So I want to say we were always open to learning about what the actual needs of the unhoused are. And I think that the more that we work with them and the more that we learn from them and get to know them as people, the more that we keep learning about what their needs are. I don't know if we'll ever stop learning, but it's like a really nice exchange because, you know, as a Black-led organization, traditionally it's really hard for Black-led organizations to receive any sort of funding. So as a Black-led organization, we are really intentional about training our unhoused and our Black unhoused partners on how to be not just leaders, but Black leaders. And how to utilize this project as a method to defeat white supremacy and also put a dent into Black reparation.
Okay, so you put a lot in there now. I do want, and it seems like it's a long journey from I want to put on mini concerts for the unhoused under a particular bridge to what it is that you're doing now. So let's go a little bit along that journey, but let me start by backing up even further on your journey. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from. You know, when I hear your voice, I think there goes a lifelong New Orleans person. There's someone who probably was born here and never left. Where are you from? What's your history? Why are you doing this?
All right, let me break it down from the beginning. So I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York, born and raised. I'm a first-generation American, which means my mom is Jamaican, and I'm like the first American American-born on her side of the family. So I was raised in East Flatbush, was always like immersed in school. From a very young age, I was taught to be an entrepreneur. And so music was my way out of the hood. So I was able to tour and write and just experience the world at a very young age using music. I toured in New Orleans about 7-8 years ago. And I really liked the city. And I visited a couple of times when I wasn't working just to see, you know, if people were really authentic. And it was true. People were very authentic. So I came back to New Orleans and they just embraced me. I kind of feel like this was like a, this place has been calling me, you know. I don't know.
New Orleans can grab you, can it? New Orleans can grab you.
New Orleans grabbed me by the foot. New Orleans grabbed me by the hand. New Orleans grabbed me like completely and embraced me. So I just feel like I've always been here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what was really special, this is the blackest city that I've ever lived in my entire life. Like the blackest, the most Black Americans per capita. If you're familiar with New York and Brooklyn, there's like pockets of Caribbean and Hispanic and Black American, white American and all that. But I've never been around so many of my people. And it does something to you. It's like this pride, like when I'm in Jamaica, this pride of just being like surrounded by people that look like me, people that are doing amazing things that look like me. There's just a certain pride that you have with that. And so I've taken New Orleans as my own, and I don't like to see anybody suffer. I don't like to see anyone suffer. Yeah. I think humanity's first. And so when I saw this need in New Orleans, a city that's so small, like, you know, you walk down the street, you see five people that you know. I couldn't imagine why we're not taking care of our in-house population. So I wanted to get to know these people. I wanted to know, like, why are they living on the street? What happened? You know, do they want a place to stay?
So this, given the fact that you are a singer and songwriter and yeah. recording artist, and you also host a radio show?
Yeah, I host a weekly radio show, the New Orleans Music Show, on Tuesdays
it
on WWOZ.
Yeah. Okay, very good. 90.7 FM, right?
You got
so
it.
given that, I think now it starts to make a little more sense about how you would think I want to deliver or share the joy of music with people who you know, may not necessarily have access to certainly not the live entertainment, but certain types of musical entertainment. So that makes a lot more sense. How did you go, though? It seems like a big jump from there to what it is that you're kind of doing now. You're saying making places available for otherwise, but let's talk about the work that you're doing right now. What is your organizing model, and what is the work that you're actually doing in order to not just deliver culture to the unhoused or to the displaced, but to actually deliver housing?
So the direct action is that we've been renovating one to two homes. We just added on the second home a few weeks ago. We've been renovating one home since July 2020, every Saturday between 7 a.m. and 2 p.m. And so we have groups of volunteers. Some of them are steady. Some people come as they want, are unhoused. People that are living, that are going to move in, Joe and Latrell, they've been working with us every single Saturday. So this build day that we call it has been a way to make the community, the neighborhood, aware of what we're doing, because this is all about beautification as well. If you have people living in homes, you have people that care about the neighborhood, things, you have less of a need for police. You know, we believe that our neighborhoods and our communities can be responsible for ourselves. So that's the direct action that we've been doing since July.
So you're calling it direct action. Hold on a second. You're calling it direct action. And you've also talked about how difficult it is for Black organizations to get funding. Is this a house that you own?
This is an abandoned, blighted, city-owned, taxpayer-owned property.
So just so it's explicit and clear, so there's no misunderstanding and there's no, you know, you're moving people into homes that are vacant, but they're also homes that are not owned by the organization or by the individuals. You're breaking into homes and you're providing people housing. Is that accurate?
No, we're not breaking into homes. We are taking over abandoned homes by the city. So if the city takes over a home that somebody has left abandoned, so it doesn't belong to a person, and now the city has claimed ownership of that home. Well, when the city claims ownership of that property, the city has to take care of that property. If the city is not mowing the lawn, if the city is not maintaining that property, if the city is letting that property go to the wayside, and there is a houseless problem, we as the taxpayers have the right to say that we want to clean up our neighborhood, that we don't want that eyesore, and that we have a right to clean up that property. So we're not moving anyone into this property until it's fully renovated. Right now we're doing renovations, we're fixing floors, we're repairing roofs, we're replacing doors, replacing window frames.
And ironically enough, if you individually owned this place and you left it and you weren't mowing the lawn and there were no window frame, the city could lien your property and could give you a fine. But because the city owns it, who's going to fine them and who's going to lien their property?
Right.
But
absolutely.
But you're identifying then these vacant and city owned, so they're public properties that are serving no social good, and you are renovating them right now with the intent of turning it into actual housing later.
Yes. And we have a new family with us. So it's not just about the unhoused, but it's about housing insecure. So this new family we're working with that lives on the same street, single dad with five children, and their mother abandoned them. So he's working 10 hours a day, 5 days a week, and those children are not in school. They're between ages 1 and 13, and they're not in school because they have to take care of their younger sibling. They're also behind in their rent. So this program right now, we're actually looking for a way for these children to get into homeschool, to get into virtual school, or to get into regular classes. We're also looking for ESL classes for them, for the family. This includes the children and the father. It's not just the house. It is about like building the community and building a way for people to be able to take care of themselves. So right now what we're seeing with that family in particular is there's a need for education. English is a second language, as well as just education. They have a need for health care with the babies. They also have a need for transportation. They have a need for food. So there's like all these things, but like when you have a safe space, which is what the house, that's what we're identifying a house as, a home. Mm-hmm. When you have a safe space, then all these other things are a lot more doable.
And how do you think, so right now you said you're working on two places. You've been around for a year, right? You started at the beginning of the pandemic, which was in March 2020. It's now, as we're talking, it's March 2021. How do you think this is scalable? How would you go from two units to actually making a dent with the number of people who are unhoused in New Orleans or in other cities for that matter?
Yeah. You know, the hope, our main hope is that the city says this is a great project and adopts it as a city project. Right now, we are like kind of passing around the collection plate. We have a GoFundMe. We've gotten some grants, but this is really just about us asking for help. And it's honestly, it's citizen driven. It's volunteer driven all the way. So I think that the way for this to be something that can be replicated on a large scale to really address the houseless issue would be that we need our government officials that we elect to really get involved with the people and not the profit of people. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, in New Orleans, people have to show proof of being homeless for 1 year before they can even be taken into a program.
Wow.
Like, so you have to live on the street for a year to be in a program. And then if they think you have a place to stay at, they won't help you. And this is what I'm hearing verbatim from different members of the in-house community.
And of course, that has devastating impacts, particularly for children. That means you have to be out of school for a year before you can get help to get back into school, basically.
Something like that. Yeah. I mean, you know, we do know people that have jobs. You know, there are a lot of people that work, you know, like a 9-to-5 job and do not, you know, live in a shelter, maybe live on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about like, how long can you keep up those appearances? You know,
right.
We're not, you know, we don't believe that we need to replace every program that's out there assisting. I think that a lot of these programs, at least in the beginning, have the right intention. But when profits take priority over the people that you're serving, things get lost. And also, this is a new world post-pandemic, post-COVID-19. And so we're saying, in addition to all of these programs, we need more programs that are geared towards the people with no resources. We need more Black and brown people in positions of power to be able to help these people. I mean, if you go to a doctor and a doctor doesn't know where you hurt, how can they actually help you? When we're saying, I don't want to name all these organizations, but when you're going to an organization that is white-led from privilege, how much can they really help a poor Black family, a poor Black man, a poor Black woman?
And you think they would have trouble helping this population because they don't understand, because they have different interests? Why do you think it would be so difficult for a wealthier, more economically and socially secure organization or group to be able to help the least economically and socially secure group?
Well, I think the proof is in the pudding. I think that if it was possible that these people, that we wouldn't have any unhoused people right now, the people that are collecting the money to help the unhoused have no idea what it is to be a paycheck away from being homeless. They have no idea what it is to be close to being impoverished. So, yeah, I do think that people that have an idea of how to help and how to serve, those are the best people that are in a position to help. You know, even myself, I'm constantly asking questions of our unhoused participants. I'm always doing outreach. And outreach means going to the places where they have breakfast, where they take showers, the places where they gather, just to talk to them. It's not always just about selling them this dream and this vision about having a home, but it's just who are you? I want to know who the population is. I want to know what the culture is. I do want to get to know that. The more I can get to know the culture of the unhoused is the more that I can think in terms of which one of my ideas are really going to be helpful.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's talk about your organizing model a little bit. What does it mean to be a member of the New Orleans Citizen Relief Team? Do you have different tiers of membership? How do you get membership? What are I guess, what do members do or vote on? What does your organizing model look like? What is your work with volunteers? What is your work with, I don't know if you call them members, but with directly impacted people?
Right. So we're all volunteers. We don't want to separate anyone, housed, unhoused, any background. We don't want to separate that. I would say the only differentiating item we have is color. And we have that because that's what society has created, a white supremacist culture. Our leaders, our Black leaders, our unhoused leaders, those are the people who's, let me just say this. So everyone has a voice, Black, brown, white, regardless of color, has a voice within our organization. But only Black and brown people have a vote. Mm. And the reason is that Black and brown people, we feel, are in the best position to make decisions about Black and brown people. However, we think the ideas of all people are helpful, but we believe that in order to defeat white supremacy, we have to start practicing Black excellence. And part of that is acknowledging that the Black leadership within a group has that final say. So that's with our Black and unhoused persons. We deal in transparency, unity circles. Every Saturday that we meet, we break for lunch together. Then we have a unity circle and a white supremacy discussion. We go around, we introduce ourselves. There's always somebody new. And we discuss why, how is the work that we're doing with this home helping to defeat white supremacy, helping to uplift Black excellence, Black voices, helping with reparations. So there's no tier system. We deal in transparency. We don't like dark spaces. And so we talk about everything. And by everything, we mean everything. There's no secrets between what we're doing organizationally. We share our annual report with all of our volunteers, as well as people that have given us grant money or donated. Yeah, everything is pretty much on the table. That's what we deal with. We feel like the less dark spaces there are, the more truth and humanity that we can lead with.
How exactly then, since you're saying that you, first of all, just you have these, you do have white volunteers saying you have this clear centering of directly impacted people, Black people in particular, but also then the unhoused. You clearly have the centering of this group. Do you have currently white volunteers?
Most of our volunteers are white. Yeah.
And then do you have the open discussion? So let's say a white volunteer comes into your organization and says, look, I want to help. I have some ideas of how I could help solve this problem or do this thing. What is the conversation you have with them about what their role is in the organization and about their ability to vote on decisions made in the organization?
Just the same way that I just stated it. We'll have a great conversation, listen to their ideas, and let them know. And we do this in our circles and definitely at the beginning of each meeting, as we state, we are, for the record, we are a Black-led organization. And what that means is that everyone has a voice, but only our Black and brown volunteers have a vote. And we state that clearly.
You know, because I think a lot of organizations have trouble doing that, you know, have trouble saying overtly or saying clearly that this is something that this is your position in the organization. You know, I think there's this general tendency.
Mm-hmm. And I think the fear comes from, and that's why we have to say it, because of this white supremacist bubble that we're living under. Mm-hmm. You know, if racism wasn't a problem, we'd have no problem saying that. But we have a problem saying that because the white supremacists are still in those dark spaces. Yeah. I mean, 60 to 70% of white people in this country voted for Trump. That is a lot of people. So that means 6 to 7 out of 10 white people voted for Trump. 6 to 10 white people really don't like Black people. Yeah. They probably want to kill Black people. That means that 3 to 4 white people are our allies as best as they can, and they're still learning.
Yeah.
So that doesn't look really good for us. So in stating that we're a Black-led organization, we're actually helping white people get clearer about who they are and where they stand with the fight. The ambiguity about being racist and prejudiced is why we're here. Mm-hmm. We have to be upfront and we have to be forward.
Then how does this, so you're saying that you're doing this work and you want to be clear about how this type of work fights white supremacy. So you are, I was with a group called Take Back the Land more than a decade ago, and we did similar work, not exactly the same, but really, really similar. And so I just say I'm really thrilled to see this amazing work that you're doing. But we used to call it liberating homes. So we were freeing them to fulfill their social function of providing housing for human beings. So when you're liberating a home, how does that, you're going and taking a, taking a city-owned property and renovating it and getting people to volunteer to come out and fix it up, as opposed to giving someone bread or giving someone money so that they can pay rent themselves. Mm-hmm. How is that ending white supremacy? How is that impacting white supremacy, either for the against the white supremacists or for those who are victims of it?
So, part of our motto, part of our fundamental goal of who we are, is we share our gifts, skills, talents, and resources with everyone. We feel like everyone should have equal access to gifts, skills, talents, and resources. And in white supremacy, white people have the power. White people know what to do. White people can tell anybody else what to do. But anyone that's not white does not have the same access to the knowledge, to know how to be self-sustaining, to know all the details that white people do know. So in this process, it feels really cliche talking about this house sometimes, because it's really just about the journey. You're right. Like, we could raise money to get this whole house fixed up and just put people in it. But it's the process. It's the process that every individual that's working on that house is going through. We all have our own individual journey to go on with defeating white supremacy. It's personal. And I think that the process of sharing everything that we know. So, for example, one of our lead construction persons is a white man. And he comes in and he shares everything that he knows. And he says, I don't know that much, but I'll share everything that I know. Well, that's defeating white supremacy. Instead of saying, no, I'll just do it. But then that person will never know how to do that thing that he knows how to do, because that skill is turned into something that can provide resources. Our jobs are really just things that we're passionate about, right? We happen to make money at it, but money could be anything. If money was like marbles tomorrow, like, all of our cash flow would be done. So we're teaching people, it's about the passion. It's about, what do you love doing? What do you love learning? And then creating the access to that. There's so many, I'm privileged, and I didn't even realize I was privileged to have been taking classical piano lessons when I was four. And, people say they don't see color, but I really never saw color until color was thrown in my face, until I was treated racist and I couldn't figure out why. And my mother and my father had to tell me, because you're black. And that's how some white people treat black people, and I was just like, what? I still don't believe that. So I come with this privilege and this pride, which tells me to tell my black brothers and sisters that you don't have to feel like less than anyone. You feel proud to be black. But this process that we go through, the discussions, the talking, the teaching, it is defeating white supremacy. We're sharing equally in everything. And we're not saying that anyone is better than someone else.
Yeah. And I think that the idea of white people giving some of their knowledge base, or sharing some of their knowledge base, is a important step towards individual reparations, which of course doesn't take away from the systemic need for reparations, but it certainly is a step in the right direction in terms of individual reparations, saying that some of the things that you benefited from as a white person, you need to give back to people who did not have access to that same benefit because they are not a white person.
Yeah, absolutely. You hit it right on the head. And I think just as a culture, all white people must share. They must listen more, do a lot less speaking and a lot more listening.
Yeah.
If we're going to flip it.
You're right now identifying, you're organizing people who are directly impacted. You're also organizing people who are not directly impacted, but who are interested in the issue. And you're renovating these homes, and soon they're going to be lived in by people who need a place to live. What are the, in doing this type of work, in doing the work of the New Orleans Citizens Relief Team, what are the challenges that you're facing? What are the difficult parts? What are the roadblocks? And what are some of the, well, we'll get to the rewards next, but what are some of the challenges?
We're really solution oriented. I don't even know if I could say it's a challenge, because as soon as there's a challenge, it's just flipped into what are we supposed to learn? Where are we supposed to grow? I really study Ella Baker, Ella Baker's style of organizing, which is about collective agreements, and that strong people don't need strong leaders. And so, I'm really all about, if we can make one agreement, we don't have to agree on everything today, but what's one thing that we can agree on? So I would say that the challenge has been letting other people know that it's okay to have collective agreements and it's okay not to agree on everything at the same time, because we'll get there. I think that the intention of the work that we're doing is so strong because we're really putting humanity first. And I don't know if everybody has that faith, but I've seen this kind of faith before, and I've seen faith and I've seen energy when people work together towards the same goal, like mountains are moved. So where we were a year ago, I can't even believe that we're here a year later. You know, it doesn't seem like much, but we've accomplished, for me, we've accomplished so much that, like, I can call Joe and Latrell, our unhoused partners, like, these are my friends. Like, I'm building friendships with them, you know? It's just a beautiful process. And so I think the challenge or the roadblock for me is, how do I get more Black people involved in feeling that they can volunteer, since we did the history of us not being valued for our work? And how can I get more white people involved that are ready to be led by Black leaders?
Both of which are real challenges. Yeah. All right. So let's assume though that you do, you're talking about how you're the distance that you've gone from a year ago and where you are now, which, by the way, I firmly disagree with you. You're just saying you don't think that it looks like much. It looks like a lot. Certainly looks like a lot from
Thank
us
you.
Looking out from the outside, but you moved a lot in a year. Let's take a hypothetical. Let's say you become wildly successful. You're working on two houses now. Let's say in the next year, you're working on 25 houses. Let's say you have more volunteers than you can manage at the time. What's next? What is it that you're actually trying to do in a big picture sense? What is it that you think you would accomplish if you were wildly successful? What would New Orleans look like? What would the world look like? What would the New Orleans Citizens Relief Team look like?
Okay, so on the, like, far end, nobody would live on the street again. There would be nobody in the world homeless. That just wouldn't be a thing, right? So that's, like, the long range. The closest...
And you think you can do that without building new houses? Because you're not building any houses.
Oh, well, you know, that's part of the process. You know, there's, like, I look at this as a spectrum. There's a spectrum of housing. There's a spectrum of displacement. And so we're like one cog on that wheel.
Yeah.
You know, there's like renters' rights. You know, there are people that are living in places that like live under slumlords. So there's like a large spectrum of housing. But the one space that we're really focusing on is that people have the right to dream. People have the right to a vision, and people have the right to a safe space. And people also have a right to take care of themselves and not need permission. So I would love to see this project duplicated in like every city across the country, across the world. Yeah. I just love to see like this happening in so many different places where like direct action and humanity is the fad, is the thing. Oh, you're being humane? Yeah, I'm being humane. You know, oh, you're helping unhoused people? What, me too? Really? You know, I would love to see a space where kindness and compassion come back. And we're more group and collective oriented than like self-centered. And this goes for me too. Like this whole process, I'm learning a lot about myself. And every time I think I'm being selfish, I just share a little bit more.
Do you have any, so you're talking a great deal about the way that you really, you haven't used this term, but all the things that you're talking about is really building community, because you're getting people to volunteer, getting people to agree on how decisions are made, and even giving up power in that process. Talking a lot about the way that you would be, the way that you're envisioning community, or the way that you are you're building community. Do you think that this model of community building is replicable? Do you think this could happen in other cities and really all the way across the world?
Absolutely. I see it happening all the time. I'm seeing other cities take over old hotels to turn those into housing for the unhoused. I'm seeing like little steps. I'm seeing things that like were done in one city being done in another city. People are looking at each other. People are sharing, and people are acting as collectives, and cities are acting as collectives, and they're not stating it, you know? Yeah. So I think that like the first thing is first,
right. They're
like,
not calling it that, but that's what they're doing.
Yeah. So like the first thing is like, we have to look at our neighborhoods. Like we have to look at our own neighbors. Like let's look in our neighborhoods and see like what needs to be done. And let's start working there. Like my grandmother, I remember her sweeping the streets, the sidewalk, Like, that's the kind of person she was. She would sweep in front of the house, and she would talk to, like, people coming down the street, like guys with their pants hanging down. She'd say, young man, you need to pull your pants up. And, you know, sometimes they would, like, say something to her nasty, but most of the time they were respectful. She cared enough about the community that she didn't care whether she was liked. She was going to say what she felt was the truth. Looking out for the children, looking out for, like, the mentally ill.
So I think all those are important parts of building community, of course, and it seems mm-hmm. like you're doing an amazing job of that. What does that, focusing on what the community members should do to resolve day-to-day things, such as sweeping the street, does that leave room in your analysis for what is structurally wrong? So if I think people should take enough initiative in their community, for example, to clean up, but it means when we're doing that, that means that there's someone in the city who is not doing their job of cleaning up the streets, and they're getting paid for it. And they're making decisions about where resources are going in a city, and the resources are going in certain neighborhoods, but not another. So are you in thinking about community and building community and being so pragmatic in the way that you're thinking about solutions rather than obstacles? Are you missing some more structural causes or structural issues?
No, we think city council, we think the mayor, we think everybody needs to be involved, but we don't think that we need to wait for them to say it's okay, or wait for them to agree, or wait for them to do anything about it, to start the process. Like, that's what we're doing with this house. You know, we met with people in the city about this project, and they didn't give us permission, but that didn't stop us. This is a good project. So they will adapt. They will adopt it. Unfortunately, there's bureaucracy. We want to shame every city into doing the right thing for its people.
Well, you know, as Kwame Ture used to say, Stokely Carmichael, shame only works for people who actually have shame. But yes, I do hear what you're saying. As you mentioned, it's difficult for Black organizations to get funding. If someone were so inclined and wanted to support the New Orleans Citizen Relief Team, where would they go to get more information? Where would they go to provide some of that support, to make a donation or to otherwise support?
Okay, so we're on GoFundMe. They can check out our GoFundMe page. Our project is called House the Houseless, the Next Wave Civil Rights Movement in New Orleans. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter as the New Orleans Citizens Relief Team. We have a WordPress site, the GNO Citizens Relief Team. But I think if they just Google, they'll find us. My number, you know, I don't know if you mind me giving up my number, but
right ahead.
I can be reached. My number is area code 347-262-7986. And I can be reached if somebody wants to work with us, somebody wants to learn more information about the program. Somebody wants to donate, see how they can do it where they're at.
Or I mean, replicate my number's on it in their city?
Absolutely, yeah. We're just here to answer questions, and we're here to just see how we can do our piece for humanity. So it's about sharing.
Yeah, and I think the framing as the new civil rights is really, really important. And new civil rights, of course, a lot of people talk about that as being human rights, as being the next phase of it. But this is a really important framing of it as well. Cole Williams of the Greater New Orleans Citizens Relief Team, thank you so much for being here with us. And thank you so much for your important work.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a nice conversation.
Okay, that's our show. Thank you for listening to The Next World. I'm Max Rameau. You can find out more about my work at pacapower.org. That's pacapower.org. You can read more in depth on many of the issues we talked about today on the Partners for Dignity and Rights website, dignityandrights.org. We'll be back with another episode of The Next World soon. Until then, please tell your friends about us and help spread the word about this podcast. Goodbye for now, and remember, organize, organize, organize.